Before I get my talk started, I wanted to start out with a joke. Now, for those of you that have heard me tell jokes before, the funniest part is when I try to tell the joke. And so, but this is an economic joke. It's the only economic joke that I really know. So there's a grandson, and he asks his grandfather, he says, "Well, tell me, Grandpa, what was it like when you were a kid?" And the grandpa said, "Oh, I go to the store, and I take a single dollar, and I buy a loaf of bread, a dozen eggs, a pound of bacon, I get milk, I get candy and a comic book, and I still have change." "Well, Grandpa, what happened?" "Well, they installed security cameras." So, that's my joke, my economic joke. Now, on a serious note, though, I want to introduce to you this book that I'm donating to the Austrian Economics Club. This is a real horrific story. It's called When Money Dies, and it's written by Adam Ferguson. And it's a month-by-month, week-by-week kind of depiction of what happened in Germany from 1914 to 1924, when they first had inflation, then high inflation, then hyperinflation, and basically a societal collapse. What's horrific about this particular book is that it chronicles this so well in so many different ways, sociologically, from statistics, human stories, and so on and so forth. So anyway, you should read this book. But I want to read this one part of it, and it tells a story about a particular gentleman by the name of Herr Hans Georg von der Osten, who had formerly flown with the Baron von Richtenhofen's Flying Circus, and later was for a short time Goering's aide-de-camp until he was shot somewhere along the way. But this guy has this story that's particularly poignant, and I think kind of opens the door for you to really understand what I call the relative and absolute values of money. And so here's the story. He found himself with a single dollar bill in early 1923, and he got a hold of six of his friends and went to do, this is a U.S. dollar bill, by the way, when their money had been depreciated in value enormously. He got a hold of six of his friends and went to Berlin one evening, determined to blow the lot. But early the next morning, long after dinner and many nightclubs later, they still had change in their pockets. And that was amazing. And then there's other stories about Americans having great difficulties in Berlin because no one had enough marks to change a $5 bill. Foreign students who bought up whole rows of houses out of their allowances. So the first question that one might want to ask is, how does this kind of thing happen? And this is one of the many things that Austrian economics is going to teach you. Now, the title of my talk is really why Austrian economics should be called reality economics, why anarcho-capitalism should be called peaceful cooperation, and what I call the peace, prosperity, and freedom formula. So let's first talk about Austrian economics equaling reality economics. I am a businessman. I own a business, which is to say that I am a professional calculator of risk and risk taker. Now, risk is always there, and risk is something that everyone wishes would go away. And understanding risk and our willingness or not to take on risk tells us a lot about ourselves and how we approach the world. I don't know if you have a copy of this book, Zach, in the library, but you should. It's called The Concise Guide to Economics by the author Jim Cox. And it's a wonderful little book that has little 2-3 page definitions of different terms and then 5 or 6 different resources. In this book, he says that the entrepreneur risks and waits. And you should note that these are two things that the employee cannot do. Now, let's talk for a minute about businesses and risk. I want to focus on, for a second, why do businesses fail? Now, I've tried very hard to understand why I have failed in various business ventures in the past. And the best summary statement I can come up with is that I, the entrepreneur, did not calculate all of the risks correctly. All of the many risks and each variable is a risk which needs to be constantly and correctly assessed by the business person. Now, there are two types of risk that a business person faces and that they have to properly and correctly assess. One are the technical risks. I own an investment firm, and in my business, assessing whether a particular market will go up or down is, for example, a technical risk that I'm dealing with. But even more importantly are all the systemic risks, which in my business mean what are the factors that are making the market go up or down and or down. So both of these are vitally important, and I want to refer you to a copy of my book, which everyone can have. I brought copies for everyone. This is my book, Secrets About Money That Puts You at Risk. In chapter one, I talk a little bit more about this concept of systemic knowledge, and I recommend that you read up on that a little bit because that's an important concept. All I want to say about it right now is that systemic risk is more subtle and more pervasive. And if I can understand the more subtle structures of risk, then I can understand why my market is likely to go up or down. And if I can do that, then I can better calculate, which basically means guess, what moves I should make next. And therefore, I need to know what is real, because the market unforgivingly demands of me, the businessman, to calculate the risk correctly, or else I lose. Now, Austrian economics provides me with the best basic toolkit for understanding how this bigger picture all fits together for real. I don't want to talk too much about the method that Austrian economics uses, but I encourage you to read Hoppe's book, Economic Science and the Austrian Method, and I believe you guys have a copy of that. And it will teach you that economics, not just Austrian economics, but economics is a purely deductive science. Now, briefly, I'm just going to mention here that now we're getting into the realm of philosophy, which is called epistemology, which is the study of how we know things. We're not taught logic in grade school. All of us were taught in grade school that the only valid method of how we know things is called the scientific method, which is great for the physical sciences, but it's not so great for the social sciences. Why? Because it's impossible to replicate in any controlled experiment the trillions of choices that multitudes of people make, the sum total of which are the outcomes that result. In short, because people are constantly changing their minds, and they are executing those changing decisions based on constantly changing conditions, since the world is constantly changing. And to make it even more interesting, people are evaluating and acting in this constantly changing world with constantly changing information, constantly changing calculations, constantly changing choices, and, very important to note, constantly changing degrees of competence. Think of a football game. This is why we don't know at the beginning of the game who's going to win. Green Bay going to win, Stevens going to win. That's what makes it a Super Bowl. But this is also, it is also true that you can collect enough data from the past that will help you guess. But you're still guessing. You're still risking. So reality economics, which is what I like to call Austrian economics, tries to look at both the subtle structure principles, subtle structural principles that apply to all human interaction, and the historic examples which demonstrate how these principles have shown up in the past. The result is that for the businessman, I can better understand what is going to happen with pretty good clarity. What I cannot know as well is the how, the exact circumstances that will occur. And what I cannot know at all is the when. For example, via studying Austrian economics, reality economics, it is very clear that fiat money is unsustainable. But when will it collapse? how long is it going to take? And what are we going to go through while that happens? Frankly, I could make the case that it could take decades more. And it is entirely possible that the current fiat money regime may be replaced by another fiat money system that may simply kick the can further down the road, followed by even another. And why do I say that? Well, I'd like you to keep in mind that it took hundreds of years for the consistent debasement of money to ultimately bring down Rome. And here I would refer you to two examples. One is the 1776 book by Edward Gibbons, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, in which he comments that the wonder was not that the Roman Empire fell, but rather that it lasted so long. And the second is an essay that I highly recommend that you can get at lourockwell.com, and it's this essay written by Joseph Peden, Inflation and the Fall of the Roman Empire. This is an excellent lecture that I would recommend you study. It is well worth your study. So now I would like to talk about anarcho-capitalism and peaceful cooperation. How many of you have heard this term, anarcho-capitalism? Is this brand new to a lot of you? Well, I should ask the opposite. How many have never heard this term, anarcho-capitalism? Okay, good. Thank you. I made an assumption that everybody had heard that. I'm glad we're clarifying that. Austrian economics has, as an extension, or I should say as a result of people studying Austrian economics, they look at these structural conditions under which economics can best bloom. And one vein of Austrian economics is called anarcho-capitalism. And it basically has the belief or the it makes the statement that government is actually the problem, that central control is really the problem, and that we will have a more peaceful, prosperous, and free society when we have not only less government, but actually a stateless society. And it's an interesting proposition, and there's a lot of excellent scholarship on it that I recommend that you read. The number one book on it is by Hans Hermann Hoppe, and it's called Democracy, the God That Failed. And I recommend that book very much. Pat has, I don't know if he has you reading any of his other books or sections from it, but Pat's quite conversant in this area. But I want to make a couple of comments that you may find very interesting. I think that we Austrians shoot ourselves in the foot by calling ourselves anarchists, because the word is equated with chaos and violence, which is the opposite of what we need. I think actually it is intellectual laziness and or arrogance to continue to insist on using this term anarcho-capitalism. It is what I would call very ivory tower. The scholars I have mentioned this to have all shrugged it off. They have an attitude of, well, that's the world's problem if they can't see it our way. And so far, my comments on this topic have not made a dent in their thinking. I think this is very short-sighted, and I believe it is one of the reasons Austrian economics is continuously marginalized in the press and media. It is as if we've come to school to teach little children while we're dressed like Hell's Angels and tell the parents to get over it. Peaceful cooperation is not only the result that we are looking for, it also summarizes the structures that we need to create in order to have it. And I felt that that comment was so important that I'd like to repeat it. Peaceful cooperation, which is what I really think this is what Austrian economics should be referred to, anarcho-capitalism should be referred to as peaceful cooperation, is not only the result we are looking for, it also summarizes the structures that we need to create in order to have it. So here's a couple of things. We will always need rules and laws. However, The peaceful cooperationist asserts that we don't need government to create or enforce those rules or laws. Will the world look differently if we accomplish any measure of this? Well, radically so, I would say, and will it be perfect? No, not even close. And why? Because there will always be people operating at different levels of awareness, and some will not observe the rules and laws no matter what. A lot of what we're going to do on Radio Free Market in the coming period is going to be exploring over the next year and more and bring to the public awareness the many non-governmental options we have to create this more peaceful cooperation. We've already done two shows that get into this in detail. One is called Stateless But Not Lawless, about the old American West with Dr. Tom DiLorenzo. And another is Stateless and More Peaceful in Somalia with Dr. Benjamin Powell. That also features Mr. Drew Helm, who spearheaded and was the special commentator for that particular show. I highly recommend you listen to those shows. All of our shows are free on our archives for free download, and so you can get them anytime you like. We're also going to significantly explore the role of privatization, which is a topic we have touched on in various shows, and we're going to build on the concept of separation of church and state, which was, by the way, a very revolutionary concept when it was first introduced. A few hundred years ago, it was an unimaginable concept that is still transforming the world today. So in the upcoming months, we're going to be talking even more about separation of money and state, separation of banking and state, separation of judicial system and state, changing the criminal justice system from a retribution and incarceration model to a recompense and rehabilitation model, which is, of course, radically different. We'll be talking about private production of defense, because national defense is everyone's final and ultimate rationalization for government to exist. And we will challenge that notion by bringing out the scholarship of Gustav Molinari and Hans Hermann Hoppe and others. So now I would like to talk for a couple minutes more about what I call the peace, prosperity, and freedom formula. Ludwig von Mises has explained that social cooperation requires a division of labor, since no one person can do, make, refine, grow, cultivate, gather, foster, raise, process, enhance, and deliver everything that they need and want in their life. And there are several keys that are required for the division of labor and therefore for social cooperation to work at an optimum level. Here's a brief outline of the elements that I consider the essential parts of the peace, prosperity, and freedom formula. Private property, rule of law, and we're going to define rule of law is king rather than king is law. Sound money and competing currencies, free banking, freedoms of speech, press, association, and movement/mobility, freely competitive certification systems instead of licensing systems, by the way, freely competitive risk management, conflict resolution, and redress recompense systems, non-centrally controlled education, freedom from monopoly in all of the above areas, and most of all, abolition of any monopoly use of force. Note that all of these are intertwined. But at the individual interaction level, it is the money, that is the blood, that flows throughout the body of mankind that makes interaction work and workable. Without money as the interactive medium of exchange, the division of labor cannot function beyond a subsistence level. In fact, it is the soundness of money that allows the division of labor of people that want different things in life at different times, and by the way, that's all of us, to expand and for social cooperation to have a chance. This is why that I see that the real battle is to be fought on a monetary issue. As the old saying goes, the answer to 99 questions is money. That is why I call for the separation of money and banking from state. Don't just change horses, permanently stop the central controlling rider, and kill dead all the weapons that the rider wields, which are fiat money, legal tender laws, and fractional reserve banking. All of these are weapons that of the monetary socialists who want, in one form or another, central control of money, and therefore over all of us and our future choices in life. If I had to pick just one, it would be legal tender laws, since that is what gives teeth to fiat money and prohibits competition in money to even get started. Now, this is a good time to bring up the non-linearity of the progress of knowledge. We all assume that knowledge is going to constantly expand and build and that society will simply progress. But that is not how history tells the story. Knowledge has been lost, sometimes for centuries. Indeed, we had a much better, albeit still imperfect, monetary system from 1879 to 1914 than we have had for the last 96 years. Other examples include Greek fire, which until the 1901 invention of the flamethrower perplexed thinkers for centuries. Stradivarius violin varnish and some principles of optics that were known in the 18th century are still lost to us today. And I'm referencing here an essay by Murray Rothbard called The History of Science, Whiggism Gone Wild, which you can find at Mises.org. Therefore, I believe we must create multiple records for the future to find this peace, prosperity, and freedom formula. I further believe we must work very hard so that it can be understood at the fourth grade level. Because if children can grow up learning and seeing the integrative quality of this knowledge, then there will be that much less for them to unlearn. Unlearning the propaganda that our current education system imposes on us is truly one of the biggest challenges we face today. How long will it take for these principles to become widespread and accepted? Well, I think if we're lucky and we don't collapse backwards, which would be, of course, the worst, my guess is maybe hundreds of years of progress dotted by surges ahead of positive macro transitions like the American Revolution was. Now, I happen to think, is a ripe opportunity period. But by the way, it's the only opportunity period that we have. So it's the only one we get. But I think actually beyond that, that the peace, prosperity, and freedom formula has many practical applications for us individually and immediately, even before we see it being realized on a broader, more complete scale. Because in my view, life is like a navigation. You must see what is coming at you to and assess it correctly. This is what every parent wants for their children and tries to get to them. This is what I believe Austrian economics can give to you. Better tools for a better chance at a better life. Now, why this is most important to me today? You know, we can just now look out our window and look at Tunisia, Egypt, Algiers, Bahrain, Yemen. By the way, I was in Tunisia on January 10th. I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a little bit. All of these show that the we're fed up part of the story because they all want the tyrant out. But what will be next? If history is any guide, it's going to be more of the same with a different tyrant's face on it. Why? Because they don't know what to change to. They only know what to change from. They only know that they want to get the grip of the tyrants off their necks now. However, you should note that the power holders and the power seekers simply adjust their grip and then reimpose themselves. This has been the story century after century in Egypt and elsewhere. This has happened over and over because people do not know and understand the principles and the importance of the principles of the peace, prosperity, and freedom formula. And they do not understand what to change to and why they should. The need is to get the freedom formula in place. But where does it need to be in place? Where is this place I speak of? It is on the level of common sense in everyone's mind. You see, there is a level in our shared consciousness that we don't question. This is the everybody knows part of our thinking process. We don't question it because, and now I'm going to be saying these things sarcastically. Again, we'll see if I can pull that off. Everybody knows that the earth is flat and that the sun and planets revolve around the earth. Everybody knows that women should not vote or own property because they are simply not as smart as men. Everybody knows that prices always go up. Everybody knows that we need a central bank to set interest rates and control the money supply to make banking work dependably. Everybody knows that we need government or we will simply eat each other. Every one of these shared beliefs are wrong, but they all were or still are operating on that level of group awareness that we all share. This is a level of our minds that we do not or rarely question. If we can make shifts in this area, if we can make any shifts towards the basic principles of peace, prosperity, and freedom, then I think we can make a macro shift in the world. So, I'm hoping that you will learn these principles and benefit from them in your own life and share them widely with everyone that you care about. Thank you very much. So I have one more part of my presentation, which actually is really now just open to conversation. I'm going to be handing out copies of my book, but inside my book I have this little flyer that I insert whenever we send anybody anything, because I run these free book giveaways on my show from time to time. And I'll read it to you because it's the natural extension of what I've been talking about. It's what I call the what more you can do part of the equation. And there are several things. I've got a total of six different things that I suggest that you can do to actually educate yourself and further this message. The first, of course, is educate yourself. And we have an education page at Radio Free Market. It's broken down into phases, you know, beginner, intermediate, and advanced, and it's very rudimentary. It's really meant as kind of a tricycle way of getting people started on this, because my experience is that virtually nobody knows about this, and so I just want to give people an entry, an entree into it. Beyond that, of course, there's many more things that we offer that are linked to that. You can sign up for free subscriptions to our shows via iTunes. They will automatically upload for you. You can spread the word. If you want, you can contact us. One of my business cards, or my Radio for Market cards are here. You can send me your email address, and if you're not on our email blast list, we'll send you a notice every week, and you can forward it to your friends. We have it being posted at, we know, scores and scores of bulletin boards and other websites every week, and so we know that we're reaching now thousands and thousands of people that way. It seems to be the best way. We also have a Facebook page and stuff like that, and what we don't have is anybody that really knows who's really expert in that stuff, because I don't have time to deal with it. You know, I focus on content when I'm not focusing on my business or my family. So, the fourth thing is stand up for freedom and rally common sense. There's a couple of ideas on how you can do that. There's some volunteerism ideas for people. One of the things that I suggest is to reach for the microphone and spotlight yourself. Don't just let other people, you know, get up in front of the world and try to tell people about this. Try it yourself. And there's so much that could be done. But I refer to this concept of this microphone and the spotlight because if you think about it, that's the key of getting people to have some awareness about this. You have to be in front of enough people that are going to hear you, and you have to have some way to get your voice out there. And so you can talk to your friends and family and neighbors, start a study group, join the Austrian Economics Club here, try your hand at public speaking, organize a marathon or concert event, write a paper, record songs, make videos, put them on YouTube, start a radio show or a TV show yourself. And in fact, I'm donating this podcast kit to the Austrian Economics Club, so you guys can actually start doing your own. So I hope you guys will do that. And but whatever you can think of, the most important thing I hope you will do is please stand up for freedom. Okay. So I'm open to, you know, answering questions or, you know, just having an open discussion at this point, but I'm pretty much done. So anybody have any questions or? Yeah, please. Well, that's an excellent question. And a question, I'm just going to repeat it because I'm not sure it got picked up on the recording, is why not just hole up in a bunker and prepare for the end of the world once you've started studying Austrian economics? I have to admit that when I started studying this, I found it very disturbing on a number of levels. First of all, one of the hardest things for me to stomach was how much that I had swallowed of propaganda, which was, or miseducation, frankly, historically and in other ways. And that was very difficult. You know, there's quite a bit of a block in our psyche. I think the psychological term is called cognitive dissonance, where we just don't want to let new information in if it makes us sick, you know, to think about, you know, what we've been thinking about before, or the way we've been thinking about it before. So that's an obstacle. But to be sure, if you start to understand the systemic risks that we are really facing right now, particularly in the financial world, it is quite fragile. And I think it's important to really understand that. I'm urgent about it because I have a 30-year-old daughter and I have a 16-year-old daughter. And I would like to see them have the best possible life they could have. And I also have, you know, a number of nephews and nieces, and I think that there is a lot that you can do to prepare yourself in the face of this situation. I have on my blog, as well as in the archives, some lectures that I've given on that. I gave a lecture in November and December to some high school classes on just this topic of what to do, what not to do, you know. One of the concepts that I brought out was that you should look at your number one asset is your job, and quit trying to make money with money per se. Realize that the number one asset you have is actually your job and your ability to create cash flow. Beyond that, you know, we could get into a much lengthier conversation. I recommend people don't try to work in the public sector because I think it's unsustainable. I think it's going to go through a tremendous contraction. And to understand just how vulnerable any industry that you may be in is to contractions. And Austrian economics will really help you understand that because it helps you understand bubbles and stuff like that. It also helps you understand opportunities. I mean, another part of this thing that I didn't read, when you get to page 108, 109 of this book, on this guy, Von der Austen, he talks about how he recognized the opportunities that this hyperinflation was creating and made himself a very wealthy man as a result of it. And there were others also. There were these two gentlemen, one Lithuanian and the other Russian Jewish, and they came in with modest money and turned themselves into, you know, tremendously wealthy people as a result of it. So if you look at the history of the world, there's always been challenges. I mean, you know, there's no Shangri-La here. What you're really learning is the systemic dynamics of how the world actually works. And if you're really understanding the systemic dynamics of how the world works, then you can position yourself appropriately. there's enormous possibilities and opportunity windows right now for people to get in various different businesses. I have one nephew that is in the process of trying to start a bail bonds business, which I think is a fantastic business. You know, it's probably going to do very well for a lot of reasons. You know, there's a lot of very, very good opportunities for all of you, and you shouldn't feel depressed about it. On the other hand, you should be prepared, because inflation, as I think we're going to see it, is going to take one of two forms. One is the 1970s model, which is when prices went up maybe 5 and in some places 10 times over the course of 10 years, which dramatically screwed my head up. Because I was 18 years old in 1969 when 35 cents a gallon for gas, 10 cents for a bottle of pop, and, you know, you could buy a house on the east side of Detroit for $12,000, you know, nice house. And I moved out to California in 1978, and I saw a billboard that said home starting at $250,000, and I just was, you know, crushed at this notion of, even though it's different markets and so on, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe my eyes. It was like the Indians watching the ships come over the water, and they've never seen a ship come in. They can't believe something like that could happen. So I think you have to approach this with the idea of how can I take this information and turn it to my advantage? And I think there's a tremendous amount of advantage that it can give to you, enormous. Okay, so, but it will be disturbing as well. You know, I think it becomes very urgent. I mean, Pat and I, we talk about this constantly. That, you know, if we could, maybe it's fantasy, but I think we both kind of think that if we could tell enough people and they would believe it, maybe we could, you know, stop this train wreck. I don't know. You know, all I know is that you can do what you can do. You have no control over the fruits of what you try to do. You just do what you do. This is an excellent question. In terms of the next election and all the conversation that's going to start happening, what are some of the more realistic things that we think might happen that we could hope for that might really help the Austrian school? Two things that I think would be landmark, wonderful things that if either of these were to happen would, I think, dramatically impact our entire economy in a positive way. One would be the decriminalization of legal tender laws. And the other is the non-enforcement of legal tender laws. Now, in other words, they're different, but they're similar. In other words, right now, we are prohibited from using different other monies, competing monies, and firms are prohibited from creating different monies. And legal tender laws are the enforcement of that. If the governments were to basically stop enforcing legal tender laws to the degree that they would allow people to trade silver for chiropractic or chickens for restaurant meals or pies for gasoline, all of which, by the way, happened last summer in Michigan, you know, or Mexican pesos for pizzas down in Texas, which happened a while back earlier, or whatever, you know, use different things for money and I'm particularly interested in gold and silver personally, but any competing currencies. If they were to allow that to occur, I think that would be, you know, tremendously great. I also think that a greater awareness on the difference between certification and licensure would be a landmark breakthrough. If we start getting people into thinking that we don't need licenses, we need certifications. Certifications do what? They let you get tested by people in your field or your competence. You become certified that you are competent in that particular field. License is very different. License doesn't certify you as a competent person. It just means you registered, you know, and that is a very, very, very big difference. And public doesn't understand or appreciate this difference. The licensure is associated with the state. Because of that, different professions can actually use licensure to inhibit competition. I would refer you guys to the Institute of Justice in Washington, D.C., ij.org. Fantastic website, fantastic organization. They legally represent individuals who are not able to actually practice their profession because of licensing problems. And there, some of them are ridiculous. You can't, for example, practice being a flower arranger in Louisiana without a license, or a hair braider in California without a license, or a teeth floater, which is a guy who actually files down horses' teeth in Minnesota or Texas without a license. I mean, these are silly, you know, kinds of things. That, or even make signs in Wisconsin, or have a bed and breakfast, or things like that. So that would be, I think, of some value. Licensing is to pull the ladder up on new entrants. Largely, that's what it's for. The American Medical Association has only 17% of all doctors as members, yet it has 100% control over all medical schools. All medical schools have to be licensed by the American Medical Association, and they have a policy which prohibits or inhibits the number of new applicants that get in, that are allowed to get in, which artificially depletes the supply of new entrants, new doctors into the United States, and which artificially keeps prices of doctor salaries up. And that's been in place since the 1940s. And so, but there's lots and lots of examples. There was, when I was a little kid, about 5% of the population, 5% of the professions had licensing requirements. Now it's over 30% of professions have licensing requirements. So the question was whether I think the dollar, it's inevitable that the dollar will be replaced as the world reserve currency. Yes, and it's a question of with what and when. However, it's an open game. There's a lot that could happen. So, for example, we could make the case right now in the northern state, and I can't remember the name of it, keeps eluding me, in Malaysia, where they actually have allowed to function right next to their paper legal tender currency, the gold dinar and the silver dirham. And the ex-premier of Malaysia has been calling on the on the Islamic world to allow the gold and silver dinar to be the unit of account and unit of settlement for international trade between them. If something like that were to occur, I think it would be short order before the United States would copy that and do some kind of reference to the U.S. dollar as being referenced to gold. And there's conversations about that right now. And so I didn't bring with me, April the 13th, I believe it was, you guys can Google this and find it, the International Monetary Fund floated a paper on how to create a one world, a actual plan for creating a one world currency. This was April 13th, I believe is the date, 2010. And you can look up the study and print it off. I have it in my archives at my office. And in it is a chart which shows the plan for creating one world currency, all the different steps that are in place for it. This is not a new idea. 1945 at Bretton Woods, Keynes presented the idea as he wanted what was called the Bancor to be a one world currency. And I believe the guy's name was Harry White, and he was the then Assistant Treasury of the Secretary of the Treasury of the U.S., and he suggested it be called the UNITA. And then there was a third suggestion, I forget from whom, that it be called the Phoenix. So the idea of one world currency would be a power seeker and power holder's dream. But keep in mind one thing. for a currency to be functional, it must have a central controlling taxation authority behind it.
Hello, this is Michael McKay, the host of Radio Free Market, with a special message to all of our listeners. I want to thank you all for listening to our show and becoming more educated in reality economics, because, as we like to say, reality is not optional. Here's what more everyone can do. Please educate yourself further. Please visit our website at radiofreemarket.com, where you can subscribe for free to all of our shows on iTunes, or visit our Radio Free Market archives for easy downloads. And until next week, folks, wherever you are, please stand up for freedom. Thank you for listening.